Hello, everyone. We are on the margins of the Riga Stratcom Dialogue 2022. And today I am delighted to say that we're joined by Rafael Glucksmann. Rafael is a member of European Parliament representing France since 2019, and he is the chair of the Special Committee on Foreign Interference in Democratic Processes in the European Union. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So, Mr. Glucksmann, the committee you serve on, focusing on foreign interference, it was established more than a year before Putin's invasion of Ukraine this past February. Has this kind of unprovoked, brutal war of aggression altered in any way what you were hoping to accomplish with this committee? Has it changed your objectives? Has it changed your goals? And would you say that this war has served as yet another wake-up call for Europe?
I mean, if we don't wake up when Putin invades Ukraine, massacres, slaughters Ukrainians, whose only crime is that they wanted to live like us as European in a democratic nation, then if we don't wake up then we will never wake up. So I hope this is the moment when Europe will actually be awake and put an end to this illusion in which we were living for so long, the illusion that we didn't have adversaries anymore, that we didn't have enemies anymore, and that history had come to an end. History did not come to an end, and it remains tragic. And we have enemies. And first of all, Putin's regime. So did it change the way we were working? Not really, because we set up this committee in order to wake up Europe. Actually, the idea came at the very beginning of our mandate in 2019, because I wanted the Europeans to wake up about the threats that they were facing. And I was fed up basically with the redfish mentality of European elites, being that at every election, every crisis in Europe, we would look surprised to find out that, oh my God, the Russian regime is trying to destabilize our democracies. And we were jumping from one crisis to another without having a clear diagnosis and a clear set of recommendations on how to handle these threats. I think the war in Ukraine has changed the perception of our work and has underlined how urgent our work was.
So following up on this, Ukraine's resistance in the face of aggression, it has inspired many in Europe, far beyond the borders of Ukraine. And some say that Ukraine's democratic resilience can actually serve as an example to the EU. So, you know, there is a lot of conventional narrative about the EU teaching reforms or recommendations or incentivizing reforms elsewhere. But perhaps it's Europe who can learn from Ukraine when it comes to democratic resilience.
First, I think that Ukrainian resistance gives us a lesson to all of us. And I think that Ukrainians today are reminding us what it means to be European and what it means to be free. And we forgot that. To tell the truth, when you are in a peaceful, bureaucratic Europe, you tend to forget the meaning of democracy, the meaning of freedom, the meaning of life even. And what Zelensky and the Ukrainian nation have done is that they have shown us an example, a living example of what it means. And this is really important to underline this, because since 2014 and the revolution of dignity, it's all about Europe. I mean, people were having this European flag in the streets of Kyiv and in Maidan, and I was there, and I've seen kids, Ukrainian kids, with this flag being shot at by snipers of Yanukovych and already Russian infiltrated agents. And when we live in the European Union, we tend to forget what are the values that this flag is embodying. And Ukrainians remind us what it is all about, Europe. And this is really a key lesson. And that's why, I mean, all this discussion about whether or not we give them the candidate status, it's pathetic, it's ridiculous. Because the soul and the heart of Europe are actually in Kyiv now, in Kharkiv, in Kherson, in Mariupol, in everywhere that where Ukrainian resistance is actually fighting not only for the survival of Ukraine, but for the peace of the whole continent and the defense of the whole continent. So yes, we have to learn from Ukrainians. We have to learn from their resilience, from their commitment to democracy and to European principles and values. And we have to raise ourselves to their level. And did we do that since the beginning of the war? Partially only. A lot remains to be done. And when you see the discussions in Paris or in Berlin, you often have the impression that we still didn't get the message coming out from Ukraine. And of course, Ukrainians will need to do reforms before joining the EU, like every candidate country has to do the reforms and get the acquis communautaire, and it takes time. But the hurt of what it means to belong to the European Union, I think we'll have to learn from them. And that's also why it's such in the interest of Europeans to welcome Ukrainians today, because I think it will be an added value. It's not that we give something to Ukrainians, that we will get something from them, and the main thing, which is commitment to what Europe is all about.
Exactly. So you mentioned the issue of giving the candidate country status, and I think it is, you know, it holds extraordinary importance, because it is all about not just giving Ukrainians kind of hope, blind hope, but it's about giving a more credible, you know,
horizon.
Path to,
yeah.
to. So what signal would it send if Europe did not give this status? So you, for example, represent France. What is the political appetite for this step in France?
I think and I hope that there will be support, but we need to understand how important it is, because when you are fighting a war, of course, you need weapons, you need equipment, you need also sanctions to make sure that the war machine of Putin is hurt by European decisions. So you need very material and very concrete decisions. But in a war, especially when you are resisting against an overwhelming force, you need also moral. And confronted with so many crimes and so many deaths, then you need to know where you are going, why you are fighting, what's the goal, what's the horizon. And the membership in the EU is the horizon. The fact that every Ukrainian knows that if they win this fight, they will be part of the democratic nations of Europe and the united European family. And this matters a lot, even for war purposes, that if you have this horizon, then you will be more keen to fight till the end.
You have something to fight for,
yes,
a future.
Yes, exactly. And otherwise, you might have the depression. So if the European Union fails to give this horizon, then it will be responsible for kind of depression that might happen in Ukraine. And this is really key to understand. So the responsibility of European leader is huge when it comes to this decision. And it will be decided now in the weeks to come, in June. And anything else than this candidate status and a clear European horizon for Ukraine will be a disaster. And honestly, history will judge these leaders who rejected the call from Ukrainians.
You know, my parents have sort of said that they tried to raise me as somebody who has good manners. And, you know, it has maybe some questionable results.
It's important.
Some questionable results. And one of the lessons that they taught is that it's not polite to say, I told you so, to somebody after some disagreement. You know, saying I told you so can be considered
that
to be...
You really want to do it.
Yeah. It can be said, it can be kind of annoying, it can be not politically correct. But it seems that in this country, in the Baltic states, in Poland, many feel vindicated that, you know, our warnings about the true face, the true nature of the Putin regime have been proven true. That, in fact, our warnings, they were not a product of our Russophobia. They were not a reflection of our trauma or our PTSD from our Soviet times, or of our irrationality or immaturity. Kind of, what is your view on this dynamic? Are decision makers in the West finally changing their mind? Has this change been deep enough? Has it been meaningful
enough? First, say it. You told us so. So it's good to say the truth always, even if it's bad mannered and not politically correct. Had we listened to our Baltic friends 10 years ago, we would not be in this situation. Had Paris and Berlin listened to Riga, to Vilnius, to Tallinn, to Warsaw, we would not be in this situation now. Had the German press listen and media listen to not only Baltic states, but also to Georgians or to Ukrainians or to Russian dissidents, then we will not be in this situation now. So yes, it's very important to understand what went wrong so that we can correct the past. And, you know, during our committee's work, we have investigated on many forms of interference. And I will take one example that shows both the naivety and the corruption of some Western European countries when it came to Putin's regime. Right now, we are in the middle of a very tough discussion in the European Council on oil and gas embargo, yes? And our German friends tell us how difficult it will be for them. But let's have a look. Why is it so difficult now to take the right decision? Because we all know we have to stop financing Putin's war. It's so difficult because German establishment has made choices when it comes to energies that linked this country and made it so dependent, and with this country, the whole Europe, to Russian gas.
To specifically build infrastructure.
Yes, and so how it happened. Let's have a look. From Gerhard Schröder, who was a chancellor, to top bureaucrats like Marion Scheller, who was in charge at the Ministry of Economy of Germany, of all the energy policy and energy funds. All those who have made Germany so dependent on Gazprom, they finally worked for whom? For Gazprom itself. And it's not just at the top level, it's everywhere. So it's a mix between naivety, we don't have enemies anymore, we should for sure consider Putin as a partner, and corruption. And the mix of both have made us so blind on all the red lights coming from and the alarms ringed by your capitals, but also by neighboring countries of Russia. And I was in Georgia in 2008 when a Russian army invaded Georgia and dismembered a friendly nation of Georgia. And at this time, Western European capitals tried to explain to us that it was all Saakashvili's fault and that we didn't have anything to fear from Putin. And that actually, well, if Georgia is invaded, it's Georgians to be blamed. And had we reacted properly in 2008, there would not have been 2014. And had we reacted properly in 2014, when Putin sent his troops to annex Crimea and occupy Donbass, then we would not have had 2022. So now the situation is, if we don't react properly this time, where will be the next war?
Yep.
Yes? On even closer every time to the heart of Europe. So now it's time to react. I think, to respond to your question, that some of the illusions have faded, but for how long? Mm-hmm. We already see some talks about return to business as usual. Mm-hmm. So that will be a fight, and we have to have this fight together. And the first thing, if you want to win the fight, is to tell the truth. So yes, tell it. Tell it. You told us so in Western Europe.
You brought up Georgia. And of course, in your work in the parliament and elsewhere, you do focus a lot on strengthening resilience in the neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. So we understand that while all eyes are now on Ukraine, the story doesn't begin and it doesn't end with Ukraine. We have to look at Georgia, Moldova, the Western Balkans, for example. Do you see that the EU is fit and ready to counter foreign interference across so many fronts? Or what sort of investments do we need to make? What sort of support do we need to provide?
So first, we are not ready. Let's tell the truth. But at least there is a rising awareness that we should work on being ready, which was not the case before, and mm-hmm. now it's there. But we need to be much braver and have also a clear narrative. I mean, if you take the example of Georgia, we have now a government in Georgia that is actually not helping in terms of confronting Putin's aggression in Ukraine, and that is actually hurting the European path of Georgian nation by jailing former leaders like Saakashvili or journalists like Mr. Guaramia. And the EU is silent, and they let this country go away without any form of clear signal coming from Brussels on what we want from Georgian authorities and what is for us unacceptable or what is acceptable. And this lack of clarity of Brussels, the message it sends to the neighborhood, is a real problem. So we need a clear horizon, but also we need also clear red lines. Sorry for the word that doesn't mean anything anymore since Obama threw it to the garbage, but it's okay. So we need clear benchmarks that these countries have to meet. But if you take the Western Balkans also, I mean, the Russian penetration is so big, so huge in Serbia or in Republika Srpska, for instance, that we really need now European Union to focus. I think that Borrell understood and that now you have a clear attention paid to the situation there, but we are late. I mean, let's face it, it's like the clock is ticking and we are very much late because for a very long period, we have allowed Russian, but also Chinese interest to penetrate and work on a reversal of the European path for our neighbors.
Maybe one final question on Ukraine. It seems that in the West, you know, there is the, even in this conference, maybe there is, many would say that, look, the West has never been as united, that we have rallied in both sending weapons, sending all sorts of humanitarian aid. The EU has now passed, six sanctions packages? So, you know, there clearly is...
Not yet the sixth one.
Not yet, okay. So it seems that, you know, there is a serious political will there. And yet, you raise the risk of returning to business as usual. And I think we already see this kind of old devil returning to sit on the shoulder of, oh, you know, maybe we should focus on the ceasefire for stopping bloodshed. Maybe we can agree on some sort of maybe Minsk 3 or some sort of ceasefire agreement where Ukraine would maybe give up some territories and so on for the sake of stopping war. And I think the latest, the kind of big name, big former statesman to propose such a plan was Henry Kissinger. I don't know if you saw his comments just a couple of days ago.
It's not the first time he's wrong, but...
Yeah. So this... The fact that these sorts of sentiments, this sort of rhetoric is resurfacing, suggests that you know, this idea of nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, that maybe it's more of a slogan. Do you think that there are risks to this?
There is a form of unity, let's face it. And especially at the beginning, there was this form of unity. Now on the sixth package of sanctions, for instance, there is only Hungary blocking, which already is a nightmare situation because you have one country that doesn't respect any of the rule of law and principles that are supposed to be the basis of the European Union. One government is blocking the European Union as a whole, which makes us understand how much we need to reform European Union in order to avoid this system of veto coming from one sole capital. But that's 26 versus 1 is the easy explanation. Now we have about questioning of unity, we need to ask ourselves what are our objectives? What is the strategic objective of the European Union when it comes to the war in Ukraine? And there you will understand that there is not such a strong unity because everybody wants peace, that's for sure. But what peace means has different translation in every capital, you know? And there is, in a way, two blocks. Those who think that peace at any cost, which means ceasefire, and we allow Russia to actually grab some Ukrainian territory, and as long as we have a ceasefire, everybody is happy. So it means that we aim for the return to business as usual, in fact. And the second block understands that true peace will only be achieved if Putin's war machine is defeated in Ukraine. And this is a key. Our objective should be clear. It should be to defeat Putin's war machine in Ukraine. For Ukrainians to win this war, which means that Putin will not be able to start new wars after or further invasion of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And this should be the objective. And if you understand that we don't have a common objective, it challenges the idea of unity. And also it explains why, for instance, in Berlin, weapons delivery is so slow, because they don't want to actually enable Ukraine to win the war for its survival, to win the war against Putin's war machine. And this is really key. And so what we have to work on is to push for a clear strategic goal for the European Union. And then we will be able to speak about true unity. But when you compare the level of help, for instance, coming from Baltic states and from Western European states, then you understand that we are not sharing all the same commitment to Ukrainian survival. And this has to change. And that's why we need the public debate in France and in Germany or in Italy to actually build on the deep feeling, I mean, population-wise, of support to Ukraine and to the resistance of the Ukrainian nation. And this is really fundamental. We won't have a united Europe until Western European capitals understand that this unity has to be built on a clear common assessment of what is threatening us. And for sure, when you are in Riga, you understand better how much Putin's regime is threatening not only the principles, but also the basic safety of Europe.
Perhaps on a concluding question, again, the issues you work on, foreign interference, election and democratic processes, energy manipulation, hostile disinformation, they are not by any means, you know, unique to Europe, right? There are we have like-minded democratic partners around the world. We have Australia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan that face similar threats. And again, while maybe the conventional wisdom would be that Ukraine has won the information war in the West, when we look globally, the picture becomes much more murky, much more cloudy. So we can see that in countries like China, Brazil, South Africa, India, pro-Russian narratives actually have a quite strong presence. And this can also be said for much of the developing world. So what can the West do to become more effective in this global battle of narratives?
First, I will be cautious about Ukraine winning the informational war, including in the West. For the moment, yes, because we are all focused. Yes, it's the top priority of every capital, so the attention is there. But the moment the attention will fade, Russian narratives will come back, and you will have attempts to challenge this victory of Ukrainian narrative, including in Western capitals. But then you are right about the bigger picture. And for instance, I will tell you something personal. When I'm writing a post on Facebook on Ukraine, or for instance, supporting Zelensky's speech, then you have hundreds of comments coming from Mali, Central Africa.
So you're popular. You have a global audience.
Yeah, but explaining to me the war in Donbas and the fact that Ukrainians are Nazis and that they are killing Russian-speaking people in Donbass. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they have like very good talking points, Russian propaganda, of course. And how comes? And hundreds of them in several minutes. It's the trolls of Prigozhin, yes? So you have Prigozhin and the Wagner group in Africa, and they work on the public opinion there. They bring their lies, they bring their money, they bring their troops. And slowly, they are winning in Africa, because European narrative is nowhere, because we don't have strategy, because we don't have clear lines to expose and clear strategy to implement. And Russians, they can count on the help of Chinese there. So basically, we should stop behaving as if Europe was an island. It's a global confrontation. And we have to work with our allies to make sure that democratic narrative is not losing worldwide. And that's why with the committee we have initiated, and I really wanted this to happen, we have initiated the first official delegation from the European Parliament to Taiwan, because it was kind of taboo, you know, how brave European institutions can be. So for a very long period, we have left this democracy in the nowhere, in a gray zone, and nobody wanted to have a official delegation there. So I insisted, and finally we went there. Not only because we wanted to support Taipei against a huge and permanent warfare, I mean, hybrid warfare coming from mainland China, but also because we wanted to learn from them. And actually, Taiwanese have a lot to teach to us, like Ukrainians, when it comes to facing hybrid warfare and disinformation campaigns and cyber attacks. And they have developed a whole of society approach that can be a good roadmap for European democracies themselves. So we should stop being at the same time weak and arrogant. You know, that's what we were for all this time. And that's the recipe for total failure.
Worst of both
yeah,
worlds.
Yeah, the worst cocktail possible. So we are weak because we don't dare to confront Putin's regime, but and people will make you pay if you are weak. And we are arrogant. We don't care what others are thinking. And we think it's okay. We are Europe. After all, they will listen to us. No, it's not like that. You need to be much stronger and accept the confrontation that's imposed on you. And at the same time, humble and try to learn from countries that have actually managed to build democracy in front of very, very strong offensive coming from authoritarian regimes. So let's build on Taiwanese experience. Let's go and let's learn from them. And let's have a united front to confront this offensive that's not only Russian. It's an offensive from all authoritarian systems that feel that the West is weak and that's the moment to actually destroy our narrative. But we cannot allow that to happen. So we have to wake up and be ready for a life of struggle and confrontation.
On this inspiring note, I think we can conclude. Thank you so much, Mr. Glucksmann, for joining us. It's a true pleasure.